Welcome to a special 93.5 WHMI broadcast of the third and final debate between 8th District candidate Alyssa Slotkin and Republican challenger Paul Young. Tonight's broadcast is being brought to you by Foguth Financial Group and First National Bank. Now live from Cleary University, here's tonight's moderator, WHMI News Director John King.
Welcome to the third and final debate between the two candidates for Michigan's 8th Congressional District, Democratic incumbent Alyssa Slotkin and her Republican challenger, Paul Young. We are coming live to you from the Cleary Commons on the campus of Cleary University in Genoa Township. To meet all the terms of our host site, we've agreed to limit attendance with us tonight to no more than 10 people. In addition, I and the candidates are all socially distanced. And because we are the only three allowed to remove our masks, the three of us have undergone and passed recent COVID testing. The format for tonight's debate will be as such. Each candidate will be given a two-minute opening statement and a two-minute closing statement. In between, we will have a conversation on a variety of topics based on questions submitted by residents of the 8th District. While responses will not be strictly timed, as your moderator, I will conduct the conversation so as to ensure each candidate has a fair opportunity to make their points. A strict sense of decorum and respect for each participant will be expected and enforced. I remind each participant that their remarks are being broadcast live on WHMI 93.5 FM. The Livingston Post is also live streaming the conversation on their Facebook page. Before we begin, I'd like to provide a brief introduction for each candidate. Paul Young is a Brighton resident, making his first run for public office. He's a former Lansing area television news anchor. He also worked as a deputy district attorney in California. More recently, he was an investigative counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee and served as an external affairs advisor in 2018 for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Congresswoman Slotkin lives in Holly. She is seeking a second term as the 8th District Representative after winning a close contest in 2018, flipping the district into the Democratic column for the first time since 2000. She is a former CIA analyst who served three tours in that capacity in Iraq, as well as an official with the Department of Defense in both the Bush and Obama administrations. A coin toss prior to our broadcast has determined that the first opening statement will be made by Congresswoman Slotkin.
Thank you, John, and thank you to WHMI and Cleary University, everyone, for hosting us here tonight for this unusual socially distanced event. I am Alyssa Slotkin, and indeed, I am seeking re-election for my second term. And as someone who is an elected representative, I believe it's my job to make the case to the voters and to do so based on both what I've done and hopefully how the way I've gone about it. I work primarily on the issues that are the most important to folks in the district, and that tends to be responding to the issues of COVID, both the public health challenges and the economic fallout, the price of healthcare and prescription drugs, clean water, especially here in Livingston County with some of the PFAS sites we have, and bringing some decency and some civility back to governing in Washington. Now, in addition to the nine provisions we've been able to turn into law and the 20 other bills that have passed the House, for me, what's really important is the way we go about doing our business. We've had over 30 town halls and public events in the 20 months that I've been a member of Congress. And I work really hard on constituent services in our two offices here in the district. We've been able to return over $1 million of money to our constituents stuck at the VA or Social Security Administration and other parts of the federal government. It's been the greatest honor of my life to represent this district. I know it's a competitive district, and we may not always agree, but it is my job to be open and transparent. I hope to do that for another 2 years, and I'm looking forward to it tonight.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Young.
Thank you, John. And also thank you to WHMI. Thank you to Cleary University for hosting us tonight. My name is Paul Young. I was born here in Michigan. My parents were born here in Michigan. My parents really lived the American dream. My mom was a teacher. My dad started at Ford Motor Company and eventually started his own business maintaining military family housing. I got the opportunity as both a young man and once I was after college to work in the family business and see the challenges of a small business and see what goes into job creation. I'm also a former criminal prosecutor. I worked in a domestic violence unit protecting battered women and abused children. In that job, I worked with police, and I know the importance of their difficult job and how important it is to work with and defend good police officers. I worked in the Trump administration at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services as a to defend our borders and protect, enforce our immigration law. So my vow to the voters is that if I'm elected, I will listen to the voters and work on their priorities. And I hope we'll talk about a number of those as we go through tonight. But this election also gives us a stark contrast with a first-term member of Congress who ran as an independent, bipartisan candidate, but has governed as a very partisan member of Congress. And she's made this clear, and there are some examples of it, how that hurts the 8th District. And I think we'll talk about those tonight. I hope we will. One example is in COVID relief. The House, the Senate, and the President signed three bipartisan COVID relief bills. But then in May, the House leadership and Congresswoman Slotkin decided, let's pass a massive bill with totally unrelated provisions that many Democrats said have nothing to do with COVID relief and will delay COVID COVID relief. And in fact, we see that's exactly what's occurred. And so that partisanship has hurt the district. Health care and the cost of prescription drugs. Again, there were two bills before the House, H.R. 3 and H.R. 19. Congresswoman Slotkin insisted on the more partisan H.R. 3 when H.R. 19 would have done the job and had support in the Senate and quite possibly in the House. And then finally, on the issue of constituent service, when you talk about police conduct, body cams would be important. And there is a law enforcement agency right here in the 8th District that sought federal funds for body cams, and Congresswoman Slotkin was not able or didn't even try to help them. And so that's another failure, I think, of Congresswoman Slotkin.
Okay. So let's get into it. COVID-19, obviously, is the topic du jour. And in fact, you know, breaking news this afternoon, negotiations between the administration and Congress broke down on another coronavirus package. You know, this comes in the wake of President Trump returning to the White House Monday. After his weekend hospitalization for COVID-19, still recovering. You know, when he came back, he said, don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it. We're going to beat it. But we know about 210,000 Americans have not beaten this virus. So in light of the failure of these latest negotiations, what specific legislative measures do you support to fight this pandemic and keep the death toll as low as possible? Congresswoman Slotkin, why don't you start?
Sure. Well, obviously, for me, getting a hold of the public health situation is key to dealing with our economic situation. And until we get a hold of the public health, we're not going to be able to do what we want to do and get back to work and get back to school the way that we want to. You know, listen, when negotiations broke down in early August on the next COVID package, I was part of a group of 50 members of Congress, 25 Democrat, 25 Republican. We're called the Problem Solvers Caucus. There's actually a few other Michiganders who are in the caucus with us. We started meeting privately on Zoom to come up with the bones of another agreement. We worked really hard on that, and as soon as we got back to Washington in September, presented that publicly. And let me tell you, the leaders from the House and the Senate were none too happy about a group of congressmen, men and women, both from both parties, coming together to tell what we, to provide what we thought was a right compromise bill. And I took some heat from my own party for that. But it did help kickstart negotiations. And literally up until this afternoon, Speaker Pelosi and Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin were working on a deal. And actually, there's a ton of overlap, particularly when it comes to the PPP program, small business loans, and allowing our businesses to apply a second time, another stimulus check, help with unemployment. There's a lot of agreement, but we were surprised by the president's decision to shut down those negotiations. I urge the president to reverse himself, get back in the negotiating room, just like I urged my own leadership in the House. It is the responsibility of all elected leaders to meet the moment, put politics aside, even with the election this close, and negotiate another package.
You know, Mr. Young brought up the HEROES Act, which passed the House, and you voted in favor of it. You know, that, in, I think, has been seen by many as something that has maybe poisoned the well in terms of the negotiations, that the package was deemed to be by some, as Mr. Young alluded to, full of things that had nothing to do with COVID-19, and therefore from that point forward negotiations have been fractured.
Well, listen, that bill wasn't perfect. I said that when I voted for it, but that was done at the end of May. We've had plenty of time for a full-throated proposal from anybody. and I'm willing to deal with anybody. So we could have heard a really interesting proposal from the Senate that was ready to deal. I didn't see that. The president then came to the table in September, and I applauded that. He was getting in a room with House leadership and hammering this out. And like I said, there was a lot of things that he wanted as well that we were in violent agreement on. But then he stopped negotiations today. So between May and October, that's plenty of time for any actors to come forward with a reasonable compromise.
So, Mr. Young, where do you stand? I mean, what legislative measures would you support?
Well, I do want to address the normal, you know, saying one thing but doing something entirely different in Washington than we're hearing again from Congresswoman Slotkin. But I appreciate the opportunity to lay out some of the things that I'd like to see us do, like reauthorize the Paycheck Protection Program, which lapsed in August. There was a discharge petition that Congresswoman Slotkin could have signed up to, but of course, no, that wasn't what she wanted to do. In fact, what I've heard is that there were threats from leadership that you can't do that. So, of course, she went along with leadership in Washington, D.C. Same old partisan politics that we always get. But we should reauthorize the Paycheck Protection Program. We should triple testing. We should develop a safe and effective vaccine. We need to continue to pursue therapeutics and cures. We need to strengthen and modernize the stockpile of medical equipment and personal protective gear. Those would be among the priorities that I would pursue in Washington. But again, it's very interesting listening to Congresswoman. In May, when there was an opportunity to get a fourth round of COVID virus relief, she failed. And that failure continues to hurt us here in the 8th District. There were 14 members of Congress that were Democrats that said, we can't stand for this. We're going to vote no. And, you know, I brought some notes today because, for example, Joe Wilson described it as Washington politics at its worst. Cindy Axne, Washington gamesmanship. Abigail Spanberger, all Democrats, talked about this package is an opportunity to make political statements, propose a bill that goes far beyond pandemic relief. Things like $1,200 stimulus checks to illegal immigrants, get-out-of-jail-free cards for criminals, and incidentally, tax breaks for the wealthy, particularly in high state tax areas like Massachusetts, Connecticut, California, and New York, where, not surprisingly, so much of her campaign contributions come from. So instead of focusing on coronavirus relief and the needs of the 8th District, she was focused on Washington politics and the needs of the Washington leadership.
Okay, but that was in May. So yep. As the Congresswoman said, I mean, you know, we're here towards the end of the year now. People are suffering. As you know, and as you've talked about in your campaign, many businesses are, you know, they need help. And so what specifically do you see that could get passed? And what do you think about the administration walking away, saying we're not going to talk until after
the election? Well, to some degree, I see what the Trump administration or what President Trump did is just recognizing reality that you have an intransigent Democratic leadership that will not move. I mean, from what I understand, there have been countless negotiations between Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and the Speaker. I think the difference is about 2.2 or 2.4 trillion in the current Pelosi package, and I think it's about 1.7 from the administration. So it's not as though that's not something that could be bridged. But you know, I look at that and I think, you know, in our first candidate forum, the Congresswoman said she looked at Senator John McCain, who voted against his party in a particular instance, and she pointed to that as example of the bipartisanship or leadership that she'd like to see. She's had two opportunities now when it comes to both the May vote and this vote to say, I'm going to reject what my party leaders demand of me, as 14 Democrats did in May and as another 18 did just last week. But instead, she stays with leadership, which leaves us at an impasse.
So, Congresswoman Slotkin, Mr. Young has, throughout this campaign, tried to tie you to the leadership, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. You have characterized that as being an unfair or taking things out of context. I mean, the percentage that he has given out there is 96%. I mean, are you disputing that number?
Well, listen, it's not just me. I mean, just look at the Detroit Free Press, who has had to fact check him now, I think, three times, and has called what he's been saying misleading. So let me just address it, because he's poll tested it, and he decides that that's something that he wants to keep bringing up over and over and over again. I get it. So the Speaker of the House has voted 77 times, right? I've taken over 800 votes. It's just a weird quirk that the Speaker of the House doesn't vote in every vote. Over 640 of the 800 votes that I've taken have had Republicans voting for that very same bill. And while I vote with my party more than I vote with Republicans, there's Republicans, including in this state, that vote the same as me, over 60%. I have voted against my party 56 times. That's approximately once a week that I've been Washington voting. And I've been very clear that when I disagree with my party leadership, I'm extremely vocal about it. I think what's interesting is that Mr. Young has taken this sort of approach that he's got to keep attacking, because he doesn't want to be pinned down on what he really believes and what he really thinks. And the most clear difference between us, which was brought up in really stark terms last debate a week ago, was the issue of protecting people with pre-existing conditions. He had the audacity, I must say, to bring up my mother and claim that my mother's health insurance was so expensive, too expensive for her, because not because of her pre-existing condition, that she happened to have an early cancer that followed her the rest of her life so the companies could just gouge her and charge her whatever they want, but because of undue regulation. He will not be clear. And it's interesting, in the week since that debate, we've had prominent Republicans come out and say President Trump is wrong on trying to undo protections for people with pre-existing conditions here in our state. But Mr. Young doesn't have the guts to actually be clear, and it's people's lives. I literally did a town hall on Friday night, and a woman pressed, you know, star 3 to ask me a question and said, I don't understand what's going to happen on November 10th. There's this big lawsuit I keep hearing about, and Donald Trump is going to take away protections for people. That's how she gets health care. People are really going to be in trouble here, and I think he's been refusing to be clear and unilateral about this in specific planned ways.
So, Mr. Young, here's your chance.
The dishonesty of that answer is breathtaking. I mean, the congresswoman knows full well that in the first forum we had, I said unequivocally and totally clearly that I will protect people with pre-existing conditions.
So then guts and come out against the administration like John James did.
This is another partisan false choice. This is another partisan false choice offered by the congresswoman. It is ridiculous to say that the only way to protect people with pre-existing conditions is for a candidate to try to dictate to the president what type of lawsuits he should pursue. Even if the president dropped the lawsuit, Congresswoman knows full well that there are other plaintiffs that will continue to pursue that lawsuit. So it's a ridiculous argument for her to make. Furthermore, the only way that that lawsuit will hurt people with any pre-existing conditions is if the court finds that the Affordable Care Act provisions are unconstitutional. Does the congresswoman really want us to enforce unconstitutional measures? And let's get back again to the mischaracterization of my position on the issue. I have been clear. She's heard me be clear on this. I will support and protect people who have pre-existing conditions. I will oppose insurance companies discriminating against them. But whatever legislative measures are needed, and I really like to get back to her non-answer about the fact that she's always voting with party leadership allows.
We can do that, but since we have moved on to health care and you've made these points, I do say you have said that you will support and protect pre-existing conditions, but specifically, how will you do that? Do you support the ACA?
I have said that what I support is protecting people and patients and their medical care. And if that involves protecting parts of the Affordable Care Act, I will absolutely support them. If there are better ways to support people on any other any context of their health care, I would support that in the Affordable Care Act.
But the Affordable Care Act is the mechanism by which pre-existing conditions are protected right now.
But it is a fallacy to say that is the only way they can be protected. And as I just suggested in my earlier answer, if the court strikes it down as unconstitutional, we better find another way to protect people with pre-existing conditions. If I understand the congresswoman right, she's just going to throw up her hands and say, darn that court. I'm going to get to work as a member of Congress and find a way to protect people with pre-existing conditions.
So, again, specifically, what way would it be protected? What legislation would you propose?
There is legislation before the House right now that is prepared to protect people with pre-existing conditions if the court strikes down that. So that'd be one that I would support. Another thing I would support is you can pass legislation that says to insurance companies, you may not take into consideration whether someone has a pre-existing condition in making a determination about coverage or pricing of that coverage. So, I mean, either the existing legislation in the House or fresh legislation if it's needed. But let's not hang on this false choice that the only way to do it is through the Affordable Care Act.
So, Congresswoman Slotkin, is that a false choice?
I think what Paul Young is asking us to do is go on faith, go on his talking points, that he's going to generally support people with pre-existing conditions.
Not generally. Support them.
Hold on. It's like asking someone to jump out of a plane without knowing the parachute's there. And we have a real-term, real-life example of November 10th where we're going to start to hear oral arguments about it. And while he says he's a big proponent of legislation, his party has not been supportive of covering people with pre-existing conditions. The legislation he's referring to does not specifically call out people with specific conditions and that they will be protected, including just being a woman. So I'm sorry, the trust factor is just not there. And if he can't be specific about what he thinks, please don't be rude, Paul, please. I'm not laughing at you. Please just let's be respectful. If you can't be specific, just like John James was a week ago, about what you think about the president's lawsuit, be real specific. Do you support it or are you against it because people's lives are at risk, literally?
Let's talk about whether a first-time candidate ought to be trusted. Let's talk about what candidate Slotkin said 2 years ago when she said, I'm not sure I can support Nancy Pelosi, and then votes with her 96% of the time. And if you don't like that 96% of the time, let's look at the next ranking Democrat, Steny Hoyer. You vote with him 94% of the time, and I suspect he votes on a lot more than 77 bills. And let's talk about the measures that are put up for final passage. You vote 100% of the time with what House leadership brings up for final passage.
But as has been brought up before, I think any member of their party is by virtue of the definition is going to vote a majority of the time or more with the leadership of their party. So back to the point at hand, we're talking about pre-existing condition protections in the ACA. And again, that's the mechanism by which it has been provided to Americans for 10 years. In 2010, the year the ACA was enacted, there were more than 46 million uninsured Americans. In 2019, that's just under 28 million. So if this goes to the Supreme Court, and if the Supreme Court says the ACA is invalid, what happens to those millions of Americans who are suddenly left up in the air?
Well, I don't know how many different ways and how many different times I can say it. And I appreciate that the Congresswoman thinks we ought not trust a first-time candidate because the way she conducted herself gives the voters of the 8th District a whole lot of reason not to trust her and probably makes it more difficult for me to earn their trust. But look, I've said whatever measure is needed to protect people with pre-existing conditions, I would do that. I've also said that I would support the Affordable Care Act as is necessary. So I return to the question of, the Congresswoman can protest and be as upset as she cares to be, and she can ask me to be upset about it too. But the president is not going to take her advice or my advice about whether he should pursue that lawsuit. And even if he were to pursue it, there are other plaintiffs pursuing that case. So, and then the final point, again, I would return to is, if the court decides that it is unconstitutional, that particular measure, what member of Congress wants to say, let's uphold an unconstitutional law? So, well, any of us would have to find an alternative way to protect people with pre-existing conditions.
But isn't the court acting in the absence of legislative, clarity on this?
I've said it two or three times now. I would support the measure that the House Republicans have in the House right now.
Okay.
If it is deficient, then we should improve it. Because I have said, I will protect people with pre-existing conditions. And I laid out not just that particular piece of legislation, but that if that was not sufficient, that we would prohibit insurance companies from making a coverage decision based on the existence of a pre-existing condition, and more than just whether they cover it or not, but that they can't use it. And look, any piece of legislation, and I'll respond to part of what the Congresswoman said, that there has to be a list of what those preconditions are, then let's make sure we have a vigorous list that protects people so that they're not vulnerable.
So, Congresswoman Slotkin, I guess just generally, and maybe I'll just throw that out there for both of you, I'd like to ask just the question, is we often hear the question, is healthcare a right or a privilege? And I guess more to the point that we're talking about here, is healthcare coverage a right that needs to be afforded to all Americans? I mean, that is really what is at stake here when it comes to pre-existing conditions. When we talk about the affordability of health insurance, that is exactly, what Congresswoman Slotkin was talking about, the issue with her mother having the pre-existing condition and the affordability you know, of insurance. So where do you stand on that? I guess, Mr. Young, is health care coverage a right for Americans?
The difficulty of calling something that costs money and requires effort from others, calling it a right, is that then you give the government the power and authority to compel people to act. And there has to be a limit to that. So, look, in a compassionate society, you want to do everything you can to make sure that people get the treatment they need. And we have that in this country. I mean, since the 1980s, we've had a law that hospitals cannot turn away people, that they have to admit them and at least stabilize them. We have programs from Medicaid. We have, I think it's nearly 10,000 federal government clinics.
I want to stop there. The whole thing about treating people, especially in emergency rooms, that's the most expensive point of care, is in the emergency rooms. The whole point of providing people with health care insurance is that we're not treating them in the emergency rooms.
I was addressing whether or not people have the right to be treated. Now, we need to find ways to do it as cost-affordably as we can, not because as a society we can provide more care if we do it wisely and intelligently. But to the question that you addressed, I'm just saying, as a compassionate society and a society that's far wealthier than it was at its founding over 200 years ago, we're going to do everything we can. I just hesitate to say it's a right, because then you put up an obligation from the government to compel people to act, and I don't think that's where we want to go as a country.
Congresswoman Slotkin?
So, obviously, especially given my personal experience of, you know, finding out my mother has stage 4 ovarian cancer while she is uninsured, and the hell that we went through of trying to figure out how to extend her life beyond the 3-month, you know, time span that she was given while we were filling out paperwork for her to declare bankruptcy, is a searing experience, and was a searing experience. And I believe that all people deserve access to health care they can afford. Yes, I believe it's a right. I will be clear about that, unlike my opponent. And I believe that if we are such a wonderful society, we should be able to care for the most vulnerable. Now, there's lots of different ways you can do that. And for me, that's the problem. This is our generation's problem to solve, is healthcare is too expensive. Prescription drugs are too expensive. I've never met someone who feels comfortable with the price of those things. But for me, it comes with certain tenets. And protecting people with pre-existing conditions, lifetime caps on how much you can spend, and making sure our kids can stay on our health care through 26, just like my stepdaughter did, to me, I think that those are important principles to retain. And what is frustrating about Paul is that he keeps punting. He keeps saying things that he knows that people want to hear, but he won't be specific. His party controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House for 2 years. They had plenty of time to push through a wonderful package that would have protected Americans, and they didn't. So any claim that somehow we as Democrats are keeping everyone from having health care and health care they can afford, we know that to be a fallacy. And so did John McCain when he voted against his party. So I think he knows how to put words together that sound good. But at the end of the day, I don't want to trust my coverage and my family's coverage to his empty promises and empty parachute. I'm not jumping out of that plane without a replacement.
And you can be sure there are tens of thousands of voters in the 8th District who do not want to trust you with almost anything for a second term.
Okay, so we're going to take a break here. We're going to take a 90-second commercial break. And when we come back, we can pick back up this conversation. You are listening to live coverage of the 8th District debate between Alyssa Slotkin and Paul Young, live from Clare University here on WHMI.
WHMI.com. It's your connection to 93.5 in Livingston County.
Visit WHMI.com for the latest Livingston area news.
Visit WHMI.com to connect instantly to the latest weather forecasts, conditions, and radar maps.
Visit WHMI.com to connect with community events and important Livingston links to area schools, municipalities, human services, and chambers of commerce.
Or just visit WHMI.com to connect with WHMI.
Like Mike and John in the Morning.
Podcasts of WHMI programming.
The latest sports coverage from high school to pro.
Contest information, an advertiser directory, the listener advisory board, and high-quality audio streaming.
WHMI.com.
It's your connection to Livingston County.
And Livingston County's own 93.5. 93.5. 93.5.
simply free checking and a free gift. At First National Bank, every new checking account includes lots of free extras. Free debit cards, free online banking, free bill pay, free mobile banking with e-deposits, free e-statements, plus a free thank you gift. First National has simply free checking for your business, too. Get started today. Visit any of First National's 8 offices in Livingston County or online at fnbh.com. Simply free checking and a free gift. That's the power of local banking. See bank for details, member FDIC.
Do you understand the impacts this November's election could have on your financial portfolio and retirement savings? Unlike politics, your retirement accounts don't go to the right or left. They go up and down. So whether you lean to the left or to the right, we will show you how you can win in your retirement no matter who wins this November. Don't let this election rattle your retirement plans. Schedule your free consultation and portfolio review with Foguth Financial Group today. Call 844-4-FOGUTH. That's 844, the number 4, F-O-G-U-T-H.
Welcome to a special 93.5 WHMI broadcast of the third and final debate between 8th District candidate Alyssa Slotkin and Republican challenger Paul Young. Tonight's broadcast is being brought to you by Foguth Financial Group and First National Bank. Now live from Cleary University, here's tonight's moderator, WHMI News Director John King.
All right, thank you, and we are back live at Cleary University. Let's turn the conversation to specifically the topic of bipartisanship and being able to work across the aisle. This is an issue that, Mr. Young, you have brought up in regards to Congresswoman Slotkin. As we mentioned before, you have sought to tie her to legislators that you and people in your party consider radical, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. If you are elected on November 3rd, there's a pretty good chance, based on available polling, you'll be in a position where you're going to need to be working out of the minority. And
are you giving up on us already?
I'm not giving up either way. I'm just saying, based on the available polling, let's just say there's a 50-50 chance. We'll take it right down the middle. But there's at least a chance, we'll say, that you're going to have to work with Speaker Pelosi in order to move any legislation forward. So how will you be able to serve the constituents in the 8th District if you are working out of the minority? In what ways and on what issues do you feel you could be successful working with Nancy Pelosi?
Well, look, I want to be clear that a big part of my critique is that the Congresswoman said that she was skeptical of Speaker Pelosi, and that she was, at the time, Minority Leader Pelosi, and that she was skeptical of impeachment, but then she went and did the exact opposite. So I'm presenting myself as a Republican to the voters of the 8th District, and I think they can expect that I will conduct myself as a Republican. But to address directly your question, look, there will be any number of priorities that if Democrats are in the majority, if they can work with Republicans to pass legislation to address the cost of prescription drugs, if they can work on legislation to get the economy moving again, to protect our borders, any number of different issues, I will absolutely try to work with them. I get it, in the House, if you're in the minority, the majority is going to kind of just run you over and do what they're going to do, and if that won't be the most productive way to represent the people of the 8th District, but I'll do what I can but stand up for the principles that I'm campaigning on and that I think the people of the 8th District would expect their member of Congress to bring to Washington.
Okay. So, Congresswoman Slotkin, you have made your reputation for being bipartisan a big part of your campaign. One of the key critiques that has been leveled by your opponent against you is that you helped lead the call for an impeachment investigation of the president, ultimately voted to impeach him, despite the fact you represent a district that voted for Donald Trump in 2016. In fact, you told the Detroit Free Press in 2019 that your job was to, quote, represent my district. That's who I'm responsible to and for. I personally believe that members of Congress should focus on their own districts instead of worrying about what other people are doing with their time. So if Mr. Trump is reelected on November 3rd, how have you not essentially frozen yourself out of any true cooperation with him to get bills signed into law. Isn't that the true metric of effectiveness, bills getting signed into law?
Well, listen, I mean, I'm happy to talk about that decision, but you're right. The metric is bills signed into law, and that's why we've got nine of them done that he signed with his hand. Most recently, right at the end of March, a big veterans bill on having the GI Bill cover veterans apprenticeships, right? Use that money. So I made that decision based on principles and because my hand was forced, because I felt like the president had reached out to a foreigner and asked for help in an American election, which spoke directly to my oath of office and to my integrity as a representative. I've taken that oath many, many times in my life, and I take it seriously. And let me tell you, it's pretty much the last thing I wanted to be working on as the representative of this district. But there are some times when you have to stand up for what you think is right. And I knew it was going to be a controversial thing. So I tried to be as transparent and available as possible. I did 6 town halls in 3 months, including here in Livingston County. They were sporty, right? People got to tell me exactly what they thought. So I tried to say to people, if I can't earn your vote, at least I'm going to try and earn your respect. And I was asked every single day for 3 months, you know, do you think you're going to lose your job over this? And I said, I might. And we're going to find out here in a month. But I have to be able to look myself in the mirror when I get up in the morning. And that's more important than just, you know, doing what, frankly, others may do, which is just feel the way the wind is blowing, vote that way to keep this job over and over and over again, and just kind of fill a seat. Now, despite that, I've been able to get done a ton of actual legislation. I've signed on to the president's signature, you know, piece of trade, which is the USMCA, the NAFTA 2.0 deal. Where I have overlap with the president, I say it, I'm clear about it. Unlike my opponent, I will be honest where I agree with the opposing party. I will vote my independent thought. And I think for me, that's how I've tried to live. And to give you an example of bipartisanship, I think in the extreme, when we had our, you know, walloping by COVID in March and April here in Michigan, I immediately started working with the Small Business Administration. The guy who's the head of the Great Lakes office, you know, he runs the entire Great Lakes. His name is Rob Scott. This guy, he was on speed dial for me to get small business loans in for our district. And the truth is, he said to me, he said, listen, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm a Trump political appointee. He actually was a real political guy. He ran Trump's campaign in Ohio. And it did not matter one iota to either of us because all we were focused on was the mission of getting something done. I invited him here to Michigan. We spent a full day together touring these businesses. We joke with each other. It's how it used to be in Michigan, where you could have political disagreements but not be so toxic with each other. That's what I believe in. I still think that's possible here in Michigan, and that is what my training in national security taught me and how to approach a job.
So Mr. Young, I guess, again, if the metric of effectiveness is bills passed, bills signed into law, Congresswoman Slotkin mentions, you know, 9 bills that the President of the United States, who you ardently support, has done that. How does that fit into your narrative that she's not representing the residents of the 8th District?
Well, I would hope any member of Congress would at least occasionally support bills that are going to get signed into law by a president of the opposite party. I mean, the fact that she's got 9 of them to brag about hardly seems worth bragging about. I mean, there will be measures that are easily supported by both sides. You know, when you talk about bipartisanship, I just have to laugh. The First Heroes Act, there was one Republican that voted for that Heroes Act while 14 Democrats voted against it, and she counts that as a bipartisan bill. So yes, of course, there will occasionally be bills that get wide support from both parties and get signed into law. So that's hardly a measure of bipartisanship, but there are so many examples. You know, the congresswoman, when she's talking to liberal supporters, says we need to get the most progressive member elected in every district. That's not the sign of a moderate bipartisan legislator. That's the sign of someone who very much wants to push things as far left as she can and then do what she's been doing her entire term in Congress, and that is supporting 100% of the time final bills that come to passage. And there are other examples besides what she votes on. I mean, we could talk about a press release that the congresswoman issued about protests in Lansing, and it said, protests in Lansing, my reaction. and she criticized the protesters for not wearing masks, for not keeping proper social distance. She said, "I guess the protesters were attempting to make a statement. It certainly didn't represent Michigan in a positive light." Now, that might sound shocking because most Democrats have been very supportive of the protests, but that's only true since the end of May. This was a press release issued on April 17, and she was criticizing protesters who were protesting policies of Governor Whitmer, of her party. So when it's a constitutional right to freely assemble and protest, and let me point out that this protest, there was no violence, there was no destruction of property. They were clearly peaceful protests, but as you can see from that quote from her press release back then, she's very partisan, not just on votes, but on how she views people exercising their constitutional rights.
So, Congresswoman Slotkin, your response.
Sure. So, I know Mr. Young is reading from his notes there, but
let the Congresswoman answer.
What I would say is, in reference to protests, I mean, this is another area where we probably have some significant differences. Everyone has the right to protest. That's a basic constitutional right. And as I said in that press release, everyone has the right to protest. Do I think it's okay that people don't socially distance and get together and when we know we're in the middle of the pandemic? No, I don't think that's a great thing. They should wear masks. Do I think, like some of the protests that we saw back in April, that we should be using swastikas, that we should be looking at Barbie dolls being hung by a noose as a representation of our governor? Do we believe that we should be using hateful, spiteful language that talks about killing or raping elected officials? No, I do not. And this has been a big difference between Mr. Young and myself, is being able to very clearly condemn hate speech, the use of violence. To me, I've been very, very clear about this. Mr. Young, every time he's asked about condemning these things, specifically like the Proud Boys that just came up, you know, in the presidential debate, that's a group that's growing here in our district. Every time we've raised it, he's said, "I always condemn hate groups," but he won't say very clearly, "I condemn the Proud Boys." Say it.
We've got to watch the tape on that, because I think in Lansing I very clearly said, "I condemn the Proud Boys," and I'm happy to repeat it right now. And it's you know, it's interesting, as I listen to that gross misrepresentation of my position, the Congresswoman's expectation that somehow I won't support people protesting when I don't agree with them. I've got, a surprise for you, Congresswoman. I support our Constitution no matter who's exercising their constitutional rights. And it happens to be easy for me in this instance, because when people protest racism, I support them. When people protest police misconduct, I support them. I don't have one standard for people whose policies I don't agree with, as you apparently do, and another for people whose message they do agree with. If you're going to take little pot shots about people not social distancing and not wearing masks, you should do so consistently, regardless of why they're gathering politically. But the tone of your April press release or note to your supporters made very clear you were attacking people for exercising their constitutional rights because you didn't agree with the message. Mm-hmm. And let me make one last little point. For people that want to hang Barbie dolls or use swastikas, I condemn that as well. Good. Let's be clear about that.
Good. That'd be great.
So since we've moved on to, talking about extremist groups, one of the issues that has come up, I'll say this, Mr. Young, in this district, there's my perception is talking to folks, and is that a group like Black Lives Matter is seen as an extremist organization that's linked to violence, especially in the wake of the protest after the killing of George Floyd. So do you share that view? I mean, what is your view of Black Lives Matter?
The leaders of Black Lives Matter have themselves said that they adhere to Marxist ideology. And I respect people when they say who they are. I tend to believe them. Let me be clear, too, if it needs to be made clear. I think the life of every African-American matters, every African-American man, every African-American woman, every African-American child, born and unborn. They all matter. And I'm not going to equivocate and talk about anything else. They all, every single African-American life matters. The organization BLM has, besides having self-admitted Marxist ideology, has also said, look, we're not about a broad array of issues that face the black community. We're specifically about police misconduct. And that's a fine focus to have. But there are a whole lot of other issues to focus on as well.
Well, so specifically then, I guess, to those issues, I mean, do you support police reform?
Yes.
Okay. In what form do you support it?
Well, just as an example, Senator Scott in the U.S. Senate proposed a bill. Then I would support that bill. I have said that, look, any person who's in police custody, it is the responsibility of police to protect that person. Happily, this is not a very common occurrence. I think in 2018, there were 20 people who died in police custody. And it didn't just start happening in the last few years. I mean, it's easy to remember I believe the gentleman's name was Freddie Gray in Baltimore, who died in police custody when Mr. Obama was president. So it's really false to suggest that something has radically changed in national leadership that's led to the problems in policing. And so many of these policing problems are occurring in cities that have Democratic mayors and Democratic city councils and have had them for decades. So if they were easy to solve, presumably those Democratic governors and mayors and city council members would have done it.
So you're saying this is just a Democratic problem? I mean, so in other words, are you...
I'm trying to suggest that the attempt to blame it on Republicans or this president is grossly misplaced. That if in fact it was just a problem that Republicans are resisting and Democrats will only address that issue, they've had decades to do it. So I think that's false. I believe my party has always championed civil rights and good policing, and I'm not going to yield any inch on that territory.
Okay, Congresswoman Slotkin.
I mean, this is sort of a typical way that Mr. Young operates, right? You didn't attack anybody. You didn't attack the Republican Party. You just said, what specific police reform measures do you support? And he just kind of goes into his talking points that are sort of the diatribe of Democratic cities, and you know, everyone's those cities are horrible, whatever. It's just a talking point. He can't name specific things that he cares about. For me, as soon as the murder of George Floyd happened, and we had protests all over, including small protests in places like Howell and Brighton, Pinckney. I went and talked to everyone in leadership in law enforcement, our sheriffs of all three counties, our local police chiefs, just to hear from them what they were thinking and where they stood on some of these issues of police reform that were being discussed at the national level. For me, it's my responsibility to hear from those folks, to convene folks who might not otherwise be in the same room. And listen, the police officers that I spoke to were the first ones to say, if there's a bad cop, we want him out. If someone got fired from someplace in Ohio, we don't want to pick that guy up and accidentally hire him here. We need money for training. I do not support defunding the police. If anything, it's the opposite. You got to be able to put resources in for the training that we're talking about. And luckily in Michigan, we got rid of a lot of the things, the chokehold technique and training years ago. But for me, again, it's just about being specific and being honest with the voters and being transparent rather than just going to knee-jerk talking points that someone fed you before the event.
Well, I think I need to address the misstatement we just heard from the Congresswoman. She said, I just go to talking points. I specifically said that I would support the legislation supported by Senator Tim Scott in the U.S. Senate, which has many different provisions as a part of it. It does have limits on both chokeholds and no-knock warrants. It has establishing new rules about discipline and firing of officers that are found. I mean, the list goes on and on. To suggest that she just did in front of all of us and in front of this audience that I didn't list some specifics is clearly false. But also let's talk about the conversations that the Congresswoman apparently says she had with local law enforcement. I brought up in my introduction that there is a law enforcement agency right here in this district that is seeking money, federal money, for body cams. I wonder if she knows what that agency is, and I wonder if she knows why they weren't able to get those federal funds.
I'm happy to talk about it, John. I am not aware of any organization that is seeking my help. I will tell you, Sheriff Murphy knows exactly how to get a hold of me. So do the police chiefs in Brighton and Howell. I speak with the town supervisors constantly. I am a regular here. So those folks know exactly where to get me if they need federal help. And let me tell you, when it comes to the fire chiefs and what we've been able to get into the district, the federal money that we have worked hard to get in for our police and fire, I'm proud of that, and I'm happy to talk about it all day long, and I'm happy to entertain any proposal. But it's not a gotcha moment in the middle of a debate. Come to me with a proposal. I'm a reasonable person.
So, Mr. Young, you seem to have some agency in mind.
I attended a public meeting in Unadilla Township, and the police chief there said that they had been seeking federal funds for body cams, and when he couldn't get it, he was just going on with his own budget. So, you know, look, I think...
Did he specifically mention Congresswoman Slotkin?
I'm happy to call him right after the debate. Happy to hear directly from him.
He did not, but what the point I'm making is that the Congresswoman, in her opening statement, bragged about her constituency services and how in touch she was with the district. That's an easy talking point to use, isn't it, Congresswoman? But clearly,
I'm proud of $1 million back. I have fought for that money. I have fought the federal agency
Does the interruption rule that you urged earlier come in? So, look, it's one, again, would expect a member of Congress to have, and they get over $1 million in budget, and they have staff people. I'm glad that you're at least doing something for your constituents. But when there is an issue that's important, and police misconduct clearly is, to not be aware of an agency in your own district that needs federal funds, I mean, I guess it's great. The stance of the Congresswoman is, come to me. I'm not going to come to you and help you with your problems unless you reach out to me.
I think that's a little ridiculous. And I look forward to hearing from the police chief directly. And we have lots of media in the room. We can easily follow up. I'd love to hear from him. And if there's something that we haven't done, I'm ready to jump in and do it. But I think it's a little rich to say that somehow I'm waiting for people to come to me. I feel I have worked very hard to reach out to people. And $1 million back for constituents, do you know how that changes people's lives when they get back $15,000 or $20,000 stuck at the VA or stuck at Social Security? We work very hard on constituent services, and I'm very proud of it.
So, all right, we've got about 8 minutes here left for this evening. So I'd like to move on to a different topic if we can. Let's talk about elections. We are less than 30 days out from this election. We have, a statement from the director of U.S. counterintelligence that foreign states are using covert and overt influence measures to sway the 2020 vote. Do you think enough is being done to protect the integrity of the election? And if not, what would you like to see? Mr. Young, why don't you go first?
Well, we've heard a lot about foreign interference in the 2016 election, and look, it's easy to say that President Barack Obama and the entire Obama administration should have done more, and I think clearly they should have. And it's also a shame that the Clinton campaign was able to work with a Russian agent and put a dossier in front of the FBI that created problems for this country for over 2 years. So, it's a shame when the government says they're doing things, but they're actually advancing Russian misinformation.
So you're talking about the Steele dossier?
I'm talking about the Steele dossier, which...
I think the general reporting of the Steele dossier is that was actually initiated by, if I'm not mistaken, the Jeb Bush campaign was the ones that originally...
I think you're getting way off base on that.
I'm following what you have said. You've made an accusation on this. I was specifically talking about the 2020 election.
If you read
election.
The New York Times and the Washington Post, they both have reported that the Steele dossier that was acted on by the FBI was a product of the DNC and the Clinton campaign, and that the FBI knew that the primary subsource was, they thought, a Russian agent, and they thought that since 2010, and yet they used that in representations to the FISA court. So I hope that our government will be more competent this year than they were in 2016 in preventing foreign influence. Look, of course the enemies of this country, the Chinese, the Russians, and others, will attempt to influence our elections. We need to be aggressively thwarting that, and whether it's the Department of Homeland Security, whether it's the CIA, whether it's the FBI, all federal agencies should be working that, because it is Americans and American voters who should decide our elections.
But I guess specifically to the Trump administration's preparations for the 2020 election and trying to prevent foreign influence, do you think they've done everything that they can do?
Look, I'm sure there's always more that they could do. I'm not a current official who has responsibility in that area. If there is something more they should be doing, I would call on them to do it. I don't have any expectation that they are actively hoping or facilitating that. In fact, you can see the foreign interference that hurt the Trump administration for years, and I would expect they would be extra incentivized to stop it this time around.
Okay. Congresswoman Slotkin?
Well, I serve on the Homeland Security Committee and the Armed Services Committee, and indeed there's been a lot of talk about this publicly. The Director of National Intelligence came out in August and made very clear that foreign actors are attempting to influence our elections, and we saw that in 2016. It's only morphed and amplified in 2020, and for me, I mean, part of this is making sure we have enough money for election security, but it's also reining in some of these platforms that allow foreigners to access and use places like Facebook and to spread propaganda. So I proposed a bunch of bills, along with a bunch of us who have either intelligence or military background on both sides of the aisle, to make it illegal for someone to buy for a foreigner to be able to buy an ad on Facebook. Just like they can't buy an ad on TV for or against a political candidate, they shouldn't be able to do it on Facebook. We passed that along with a bunch of other provisions, but it sort of just sat on the desk, in the Senate, and we hasn't moved anywhere after passing the House on a bipartisan basis. So I don't think we've done everything we can, and I think, frankly, the president has really sort of made light of this whole thing and not taken it seriously when we know that, in particular, the Russians have a preference. That's something the intelligence community has said publicly, that they have a preference for President Trump.
Hasn't the community also said that the Chinese have a preference for Joe Biden?
They have. As someone who sees the classified information, I will just tell you that there's a real false equivalency between the level of effort that the Russians are making, given their experience, their breadth on this, and the sort of what I would call normal level Chinese espionage that goes on every single day. As a CIA officer, that's a standard thing. But just this past week, we had the intelligence community make clear that they have no specific threats on the election from the Chinese, where they have a very specific threat from the Russians.
Okay. Well, believe it or not, we are almost out of time. This evening has flown by, so I want to give you both an opportunity to provide your closing statements. Congresswoman Slotkin, we're going to have you give your statement first, and then Mr. Young, you can speak last. Congresswoman Slotkin.
Sure. So, again, thank you for holding the forum. I think it's important that we have opportunities to be transparent with the public and be available and get asked tough questions. For me, again, I have worked very hard to try and be as available as I can to this district, knowing that it's a very independently minded district. I am a very independently minded member of Congress, and I think you'll hear that whether it's the Chamber of Commerce endorsing me, whether it's my Republican colleagues, or my fellow Democrats. I am one of the most bipartisan members of Congress. I believe in it in my bones because of my experience working in national security, and I believe between what we've been able to get done and the way we've gone about it, that we have hopefully made the value proposition for people to either vote for the first time for me or maybe for the second time. It has been the most profound experience of my life, and I say that as someone who served in the CIA and at the Pentagon. My husband's in service for 30 years. But when you are a member of Congress, people want to tell you their pain, and they expect you to go and fight for them in Washington. That is something that I have tried to do. It has been my honor and my privilege, and I hope to continue to do it after November.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Young will give you the last word.
Thank you, John. And again, thank you to everyone that tuned in tonight to listen. I'll just recap a little bit what I talked about at the top, that I thought that this would give us an opportunity to do at least two things. One, demonstrate whether it's through the HEROES Act, whether it's through prescription drug pricing, or whether it's through the failure to serve our constituents with a specific example of aiding a police agency seeking federal funds, that the Congresswoman talks one thing but produces another. And her partisanship and her D.C. politics do not serve this district well, and I think we deserve better. As I said at the top as well, my commitment to you is that I will listen to you and that I will work on the priorities that you want to see worked on in Washington, D.C. And as I work across the district in Ingham County, in Livingston County, and in Oakland County, what I hear people talking about is that they want to see the coronavirus defeated. And I talked tonight about many of the things that I would do to prioritize relief and addressing the coronavirus. As I talk to voters in this district, what I hear from them is that they want to get back to work and they want to get back to school and they want to do that safely. And I will, as someone who has worked as a prosecutor and someone who's worked in a small business, I'm going to bring the skills and qualities I learned there to making those priorities a reality to you if you trust me with your vote on November 3rd. Thank you.
All right. Well, I would like to thank both candidates for being here tonight and taking part in this discussion. Again, Paul Young, Republican challenger, and Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, 8th District Democrat, seeking a second term. And I want to thank as well Cleary University for providing us the host site for tonight's event. Extremely generous hosts. Thank you very much. And once again, thank you very much for everybody for tuning in here on WHMI.